Hello there, I'm Nick Clark. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, China's zero COVID policy is over. Despite a surge in cases, the country has opened its doors to the rest of the world. Will that help revive the economy? And what are the global implications? Also this week, Europeans have been bracing for a difficult winter because of the energy crunch, but gas storage facilities are almost full and prices fell from record highs. So, did Europe overcome its energy crisis? Plus, we explore why savvy young Zimbabwean graduates are trading a seat at the boardroom table for a chance to work the land. So, 3 years of citywide lockdowns and border closures in China have disrupted supply chains, squeezed businesses, and caused widespread economic damage. Now, as Beijing joins the rest of the world in adapting to life with the virus, the lifting of its strict COVID-19 policy is bringing both relief and uncertainty. Rolling back pandemic rules is meant to revitalize the economy, but it's also led to new outbreaks. Factory activity shrank in December at the sharpest pace in nearly 3 years as COVID infections swept through production lines across the country. China has been struggling with a drop in retail sales, consumer spending and record unemployment rates. But virus curbs weren't the only factor dragging down the Chinese economy. The country's property sector is in crisis and trade, which makes up around a fifth of China's GDP, took a hit from the global economic slowdown. Well, the country's reopening could have huge implications for the rest of the world too. Among the sectors expected to benefit from the lifting of restrictions on foreign travel is the global hospitality sector. But while some countries offered travellers coming from China a warm welcome, others imposed travel requirements. Tony Cheng has this now from Bangkok.
Rolling out the red carpet for honoured guests. Three ministers and a host of senior government officials welcome passengers on a flight from Xiamen in southern China. Gift bags and garlands. But for the tourists, it was reward enough to be able to travel overseas.
Here it's warm and the people are very friendly and we feel safe here. And here also have a beautiful beach, delicious fruit and everything's well.
As the tourists moved through the airport, neither they nor any of the other arrivals were required to show vaccine certificates. The Civil Aviation Authority had hurriedly announced all passengers would be required to show proof of vaccination or immunity from COVID-19, regardless of their country of origin. But the health minister backtracked. Thailand is dropping vaccine requirements despite concerns that an influx of Chinese tourists could bring new variants of the virus.
By not imposing restrictions.
Speaking to Al Jazeera, the minister explained he wanted to do everything to encourage visitors to come.
We evaluate the risk and the opportunity together.
And your evaluation is that there is no risk?
There is still risk, but we have things to overcome those risks.
You mean the financial risks of not inviting people in?
Pardon me?
You mean the economic risks
all,
of not
all
having...
All concerned risks.
This abrupt U-turn is an indication of the fact that Thailand wants tourist arrivals from anywhere in the world. The fact they're hoping for 10 million arrivals from China by the end of the year is also an indication of how reliant Thailand is now on arrivals from China.
Other Asian nations are also hoping to lure back Chinese tourists. Japan was one of the most popular pre-pandemic destinations for Chinese travellers, although now they'll have to show negative COVID-19 tests. But no entry requirements for Bali. Like Thailand, Indonesia has dropped all coronavirus curbs, although it expects visitor numbers will remain low. Thailand, however, needs to get back to pre-pandemic visitor levels fast.
I'm happy the Chinese tourists are coming back. We haven't been able to make a living. We all suffered while they were gone.
With only 1 million Chinese arrivals expected in the first quarter of the year, that might be wishful thinking. But with the Beijing government lifting all travel restrictions, many Asian countries will be hoping Chinese visitors make the most of their newfound freedom.
So let's take this on. From London, I'm joined by Shirley Zi Yu, who's a senior practitioner fellow with the Ash Centre of Harvard Kennedy School and a visiting senior fellow at the London School of Economics. Shirley, welcome to the programme. So first up, China's reopening is a big deal, isn't it? Do you expect a quick economic recovery, or might it be hampered by the surge in infections?
Good morning, Nick. The infection rate has topped 80% in most of the economically developed regions in China. And the virus will continue to spread in the rural regions in the coming months. However, because of the fact that most of the industrial supply chains are spread across China's economically connected regions, so the supply chain recovery itself will be pretty quick and pretty strong. The government can always invest in infrastructure to give the economy some needed dose of boost. However, consumption is really 60% of the Chinese economy. So unless we see the consumer demand to pick up, we do not really see the signs of a sustainable structural recovery yet.
Right. And that's the thing, isn't it? Because consumer and business confidence has been really hit by the COVID pandemic. So how will the government set about trying to restore that confidence?
I absolutely agree with you. I think some consistency in the government policy setting would be crucial to boost the consumer and business confidence. Chinese consumers have saved 17 trillion RMB in 2022, Nick, and that's roughly almost close to $3 trillion. And so consumers are really opting for saving rather than investing or consuming. And I think talking about consistency in the past couple of years, we have seen a lot of policies that have not been consistent. First of all, it was to crack down on the real estate sector, and now it's to rescue the sector. It was to crack down on China's big tech, and now it's supporting the big tech. And it was zero COVID containment for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden, overnight, it's changed to letting the virus spread as quickly as possible. So no matter if you're a consumer or a business entrepreneur, you really don't know what's going to happen next. And so I think the government really has a lot of job to do to send a strong and consistent message to the public, and one of which is to be pro-private business. I think the Chinese president has recently openly supported the legitimate role of Chinese private companies. Zhejiang government, the government where Alibaba is headquartered, actually visited the company and established a strategic partnership there. And I think above all, it is really important for the Chinese government to send a message out and that expresses the consistency that economic growth, rather than this ideological or political struggle, will continue to be China's overarching priority for the foreseeable future.
Right. And another area that the government has had to focus on is trying to revive the property sector. Has it done enough, do you think?
Never enough. It's on the road because we haven't seen really the stabilization of the real estate sector yet. The sector really faces a structural demographic challenge. China's new birth number in 2022 hit a new low. So there are just simply too many homes for increasingly fewer population. But the purpose of the government today is really not to incite another era of high growth in the real estate sector. It is really trying to avert a systemic financial crisis. It's trying to save the banks, the banking sector. It's also trying to save the local governments, who are not only heavily indebted today, but they are heavily reliant on real estate land sales revenue for their fiscal receipts. And so really what the government is trying to achieve here is to avert a spillover from the real estate crisis into the banking sector. The real estate sector is not likely to see high levels of growth for a very long time. But will the government be able to avert a systemic financial collapse? I think so. I think the government still has a lot of tools, both monetary and the fiscal, to deploy when needed.
All right. What about money coming in from overseas, foreign investment? How's that shaping up?
That's the area that's been really contentious. China will always welcome foreign direct investment, but given the structure of the Chinese economy today, Nick, the FDI that China tries to lure will increasingly be leaning towards the high-end sectors, high-tech, high-end manufacturing, finance, and the public health, etc. And the recent Paxlovid negotiation that broke down between the Chinese national insurance provider and Pfizer really shows that we understand that China inquired about the possibility of Pfizer developing or producing a generic version in China for the Chinese consumers. And so as China rivals up to the global tech frontier, I think the concerns will remain that as China becomes more and more powerful in technology, China will try to come up with a domestic version of the Western counterparts, and that'll put the Western counterparts at a disadvantage.
So China trying to, you know, reconnect with the rest of the world, but at a time when its relations with the US, well, they're not great, are they? And the global economy is continuing to slow. So what impact will all of that have on the economic plan?
I think we have to re-envision the next era of globalization. I think RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership that was established between the ASEAN countries and the rest of the Asian neighbors, will continue to generate a true trade and economic integration in the Asia-Pacific region. China has clearly expressed the interest and effort in trying to apply for a membership in the CPTPP, which is a higher bar regional trade and economic agreement. And I think today we're starting to see increasingly with clarity that the US and the Chinese forces are trying to mutually exclude each other from their own industrial supply chains, particularly at the high end. And so I think the next era of globalization, we're starting to see two parallel systems of globalization with the Chinese and the U.S. Economies at the center. And then there will be two parallel forms of globalization going on at the same time in across Asia, Europe, and increasingly Africa.
So, and finally, just Shirley, just rewinding back to this reopening of China's economy. It's come sooner than expected for many. Goldman Sachs, for one, suggested that will lead to supply chain issues. Is that a problem, do you think?
I think Goldman Sachs has been warning about short-term supply chain disruptions. On balance, I think China's reopening and rejoining the world, as you say, is a positive for the global economy. And obviously another concern on the horizon is how will the pickup in Chinese consumer demand and also the production capacity from within China is going to add to the resilience of global inflation. So there's quite a lot to consider there.
All right, Shirley Ziyu, it's just great to have your analysis. We appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Nick.
So it's been considered Europe's worst nightmare in decades. The energy crunch caused by Russia shutting off gas supplies was expected to get worse and even spiral out of control in the winter. Factories did go dark and the heating was turned down as European households and businesses bore the brunt of hefty energy bills. But after months of striving to secure supplies and lower the cost of switching on the lights and cooking meals, Europe's fortunes may have turned. Natural gas prices in Europe and the United States fell to their lowest levels since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Wholesale European gas prices, as measured by the benchmark Dutch futures contract, have fallen to $77 per megawatt hour early this month. And they've soared to an all-time high of $364 back in August. Well, energy prices rocketed after Russia stopped the flow of gas through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Europe, citing technical problems. The EU has accused Moscow of using energy as a weapon in retaliation for Western sanctions imposed on Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. Well, the bloc boosted imports from Norway to replace Russian gas and snapped up supplies of liquefied natural gas, mostly from the United States and Qatar. They also raced to build facilities needed to receive LNG by ships and convert it into gas that can be transported through pipelines. European nations filled up their storage facilities and encouraged consumers to use less gas by setting a voluntary 15% reduction target. Some nations have shifted back to coal and restarted nuclear plants and rolled out ambitious renewable energy plans. All the while, Russia has increased gas exports to China in an attempt to reduce its dependence on the European market. Well, joining me now from Vienna is Johannes Benigni. Johannes is the chairman and executive officer of JBC Vienna. Johannes, welcome to the programme. First up, so there we were, fearing the winter of soaring prices, and in fact, gas prices have slumped. Is that just down to the warm weather that we've had across Europe so far this winter, or indeed action taken by nations?
Well, it's a combination, really. The expensiveness of the gas supply has motivated many of the consumers, many of the industries to reduce their demand. Some of the businesses simply have shut down. They prefer to make money by selling their natural gas. Others obviously are reducing their consumption because it's so expensive. But they were also lucky because the winter weather so far has been fairly mild. And let's face it, we have seen still supply from Russia, which has prevented the worst thing to happen. So there is reduced supply from Russia. They managed to fill the inventories beforehand. So far, yeah, they were lucky.
You use the phrase there so far twice, in particular referring to the winter weather. I mean, there could yet be a big freeze. Would that change things radically?
Well, it won't change anything for this year. I think for this winter, we are over the top of the most difficult time. The inventories are reasonably full, so they will manage to go through this winter. The problem comes in the next heating season, simply because you have to bear in mind, in 2022, a lot of the natural gas that is on inventory right now has still come out of Russia. And because the supplies were still working fully till the middle of the year. Now, this year, Nord Stream 1, you know, at least currently is unlikely to operate. Nord Stream 2 could, in theory, operate, but that is politically not very, very, very easy to handle. So this year is going to be very difficult in the refill process.
We talk about this drop in prices, but the consumers aren't seeing that, are they? At what point will they see a drop in prices to their energy bills?
The question is, in whose interest is it? The governments are really trying to motivate the consumers not to maintain demand on a high level. Mm-hmm. Now, once prices decline, obviously the consumers don't feel the pressure so much, and they would maybe increase consumption again. So I think right now, you know, it's in the interest of the governments to demotivate the consumers to consume more. That's why it's going to be very funny if you see prices dropping. That would be unusual.
How long do you think governments can continue to intervene to keep prices down?
I mean, right now, the winter should do most of it. Thereafter, when prices are falling, obviously, it's going to be a bit more difficult for them not to allow that, you know, price drop to happen. So right now, you see a lot of motivation for everyone not to consume as much as before. But I mean, we have to face this decline in prices is not only a European sphere, right? Europe right now is benefiting from two factors in the market, apart from the weather. Number one is that China is not yet back on its feet. And number two, simply because the high natural gas prices not only have motivated European consumers to consume less, we have seen a whole bunch of Asian countries that were turning away from coal in using more natural gas, basically to revert back to coal. Now, that means they were priced out. And this is basically, to some degree, helping the European supply situation.
You mentioned China. What are the implications of China's reopening on Europe's energy market?
Well, it's dramatic. I mean, China in the last couple of years has become globally the biggest player on the LNG market. It has successfully reduced the share of coal in its energy portfolio by, you know, basically increasing the gas element in it. Now, we have seen the last 1-2 years, I mean, particularly the year 2022, there was no increase in consumption in terms of natural gas in China, for obvious reasons, COVID and economic slowdown. And now, you know, it doesn't matter to whom you speak, everyone would expect this year there will be a comeback. Now, that may be happening, may not, but if it happens, clearly China is a dominant player in the LNG market. And it would be then, you know, compete with Europe. That would then drive prices higher.
Right. And will that benefit Russia? Because China would be a client of Russia, right?
Well, I mean, right now, the funny thing is Russia doesn't sell so much piped gas to Europe, but it sells a lot of LNG to Europe. It's so funny. I mean, it's the strategy in terms of sanctions in Europe is not very well balanced. But right now, Russia is making more inroads in the LNG market. Of course, the pipeline supply into China is one topic. But bear in mind, that takes many years to go because building and expanding pipelines, the ones that are in place right now have been basically approved and built and investment decisions were taken, 5 to 10 years ago. So whatever happens right now has been decided many years ago. So this is not a one day to the other exercise. But yes, they will in the medium term build more capacity into Asia.
What's happened finally, Johannes, has inspired a change in the approach to the renewable energy build across Europe. Is that going to continue, do you think, and will it gain momentum?
Well, we see that right now. The European Commission is basically mandating member countries to accelerate the approval process for renewable projects. Many countries that are now executing that, in Austria they just did approve it. And that means that you can build wind parks, solar parks faster than before. That will help. But bear in mind that that is not an immediate solution. This is going to take a couple of years till that is translating into more energy independence. In the meantime, what is happening is that the relatively low amount of carbon dioxide that is in natural gas has been swapped against a higher amount of carbon dioxide in coal. Because you see everywhere right now in Europe that coal is helping out to provide energy. And that basically comes at the cost, not only in Asia, right, what I mentioned before, but it comes at the cost also in Europe in terms of moving away from, fossil fuels and then high carbon energy.
Johannes Benyiyi, good to get your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, the soaring cost of living and rising interest rates are curbing consumers' appetite for shiny electronic devices. Samsung, which is the world's biggest manufacturer of memory chips, smartphones and TVs, says its profits for the last 3 months of 2022 plunged by almost 70%. That is the lowest level in 8 years. Well, the South Korean company has been struggling with weak demand for memory chips, smartphones and displays as consumers tamp down on spending. Samsung is the latest major technology company to be hit by a drop in sales as concerns grow about a global economic downturn. Well, unemployment is high in Zimbabwe and most of the population of 14 million is working informally to make ends meet. Many young graduates with degrees in business, in law, in finance and in technology who can't find a job in their fields are switching to farming to try and earn a living. Harry Matassa reports now from the Gramonzi district in eastern Zimbabwe.
Unico Chikomo has a master's degree in international trade law, but finding a job in Zimbabwe is difficult. So in 2018, he became a farmer and now employs several people. The 30-year-old is one part of a new generation of educated youths who work the land to create livelihoods. But navigating the country's farming industry isn't easy.
The biggest challenge we've got is an issue of finance or capital. And for even young people to be able to walk into a bank, you've got no collateral, you've got probably no history, or you've got no storyline to tell how viable your business or your idea is, and also even the access to land.
The state, some banks, and the private sector help finance farmers, but many say they can't get the help they need to get started.
This country has a lot of fertile land, but since land reform, when commercial farmers were seized from white and given to black Zimbabweans, some of that land is not being fully utilized. More young people here say they can help increase productivity.
In another part of the country, Valerie Madziwa and her husband are preparing to export watermelons to the Middle East.
Zimbabwe is strategically located because most of this product, they are getting it from Australia and Brazil. Zimbabwe is just 21 to 28 days to Dubai, whereas when you look at Brazil, they're looking at over 35 days on water.
Old infrastructure, electricity shortages, and an inflation rate of more than 200% are some of the factors holding back Zimbabwe's farmers.
It really depends on the performance of the economy. Whether the youth are going to be successful, it really depends on the performance of the economy. If the economy improves, so are the prospects of farmers.
Valerie believes farming could be one solution to the country's unemployment problem. But young people say for that to work, they must have access to the resources they need to thrive.
And that is our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything you've seen, you can tweet me at Nick Clark Al Jazz using the hashtag AJCTC, or drop us an email. countingthecosts@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. So that's it for this edition of Counting the Costs. I'm Nick Clark from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is coming up.